my investigation was going. Maybe he'd provide some inspiration for a change. I thought about the professional implications of the conversation. According to the state bar rules of court, an attorney is not permitted to communicate directly with the represented party. A private investigator isn't limited by the same stringent code. 5 minutes, I said. I have to be somewhere after that. I didn't tell him the appointment was with his ex-wife. I turned the engine off and remained in my car with the window rolled down halfway. He closed his eyes, letting out a big breath. Thank you, he said. I really didn't think you'd do this. I don't even know where to begin, he said. Let me admit to something right up front. I pulled your distributor caps. It was a sneaky thing to do, and I apologize. I just didn't think you'd agree to talk to me otherwise. You got that right, I said. He looked off down the street, and then he shook his head. Did you ever lose your credibility? It's the most amazing phenomenon. You know, you live all your life being an upright citizen, obeying the law, paying taxes, paying your bills on time. Suddenly none of that counts, and anything you say can be held against you. It's too weird. I tuned him out briefly, reminded of a time, not that long ago, when my own credibility went south, and I was suspected of taking bribes by the very company that had trusted me with its business for 6 years. Really thought it was over. I thought I'd come through the worst of it when I was acquitted on the criminal charges. I just got my life back, and now I'm being sued for everything I own. I live like a leper. I'm shunned. He straightened up. Oh, hell, let's not even go into that, he said. I'm not trying to generate sympathy. What are you trying to do? Appeal to your sense of fair play. This guy McIntyre, the informant. Where'd you get that name? My attorney took his deposition. I was floored when I heard what he had to say. I'm not at liberty to discuss this, Mr. Barney. I hope you understand that. I know that. I'm not asking. I just beg you to consider. Even if he'd actually been in the courthouse when the verdict came down, why would I say such a thing to him? I'd have to be nuts. Have you met... what's his name? Curtis. I was in a cell with a man less than 24 hours. The guy's a schmuck. He comes up to me on acquittal, and I confess to murder? The story's crazy. He's an idiot. You can't believe that. I was feeling oddly protective of Curtis. There was no way I was going to tell Barney the informant had changed his account. Curtis's testimony might still prove useful if we could ever figure out what the truth was. I didn't intend to discuss the details of his statement, however shaky it might appear. This isn't such a hot idea, I said. Barney went on. Just think about it, please. Does he strike you as the type I'd confide my darkest secrets to? This is a frame-up. Somebody paid him to say that. Get to the point. The talk about a frame-up is horseshit. I don't want to hear it. Okay, okay. I understand where you're coming from. That wasn't my intention anyway, he said. When we spoke on the phone, I mentioned the business about this guy Shine. I was thrown by his death. It really shook me, I can tell you. I know you didn't take me seriously at the time, but I'm telling the truth. I talked to him last week and told him the same stuff I'm telling you. He said he'd check into a couple of matters. I thought maybe the guy was going to give me a break. When I heard he was dead, it scared the hell out of me. I feel like I'm playing chess with an invisible opponent, and he just made a move. I'm getting boxed in here, and I don't see a way out. Wait a minute. Did you think Morley Shine would do something your own attorney couldn't manage? Hiring Foss on this one was a big mistake. Civil work doesn't interest him. Maybe he's burned out, or maybe he's just tired of representing me. He's strictly painting by the numbers, doing what's expected as far as I can see. He's got some investigator on it. One of those guys who generates a lot of paper but doesn't inspire much confidence. So why don't you fire him? Because they'll claim all I'm doing is impeding due process. Besides, I've got no money left. What little I have goes to pay my attorney, plus the upkeep on the house. I don't know what Kenneth Voigt thinks he's going to get out of the deal, even if he makes this thing stick. I'm not going to argue the merits of the case. This is pointless, Mr. Barney. I understand you have problems. Hey, you're right. I didn't mean to go off on that stuff. Here's the point. This case goes into court. All it's going to do is make both these attorneys rich. But Voight's not going to back off. The guy's after my blood, so there's no way he'll agree to walk off with a handshake and a check for big bucks, even if I had it. But I'll tell you one thing. And here's what I do have. I've got an alibi. Really? I said, my voice flat with disbelief. Yes, really, he said. It's not airtight, but it's pretty solid. Why didn't it come up during the criminal trial? I've read the transcripts. I don't remember any mention of an alibi. Well, you better go back and read the transcripts again, because the testimony's right there. Guy named Angeloni. He put me miles from the crime scene. And you never testified in your behalf? He shook his head. Foss wouldn't let me. He didn't want the prosecution to get a crack at me, and it turned out he played it smart. He said it'd be counterproductive if I took the stand. Hell, maybe he thought I'd alienate the jury if I got up there. Why tell me about it? To see if I can put a stop to this before it goes to trial. The meter's ticking. Time is short. I figure my only chance is to make sure Lonnie Kingman knows the cards he's got out against him. Maybe he can talk to Voight and get him to drop his suit. Have Herb Foss talk to Lonnie. That's what attorneys are supposed to do. I've asked him to do that. The guy is jerking me around. I finally decided it's time to circumvent the man. So you're tipping me off to your own attorney's defense? That's right. Are you suicidal? I told you I'm desperate. I can't go through this again. You don't have to take my word for it. Check the facts yourself, he said. Now, do you want to hear me out or not? What I wanted was to bang my forehead against the steering wheel till it bled. Maybe the self-inflicted pain would help me clear my thought processes. Actually, I have to confess, I was hooked. If nothing else, knowing Herb Foss's strategy would give Lonnie a big advantage, wouldn't it? Jesus, all right, what's the story, I said. Chapter 11. Look, I know people don't believe I was out jogging the night Isabel was killed, but I can tell you where I was. At 1:40, I was at the southbound off-ramp at San Vicente and the 101, which is probably 8 miles from the house. If Iz was killed between 1 and 2, there's no way I could have done it and still ended up at that intersection when I did. I mean, I've been running for years, and I'm in pretty fair shape, but I'm not that good. How can you be so sure of the time? I was running for time. That's how I train. And I'll tell you who else was there. Tippi Parsons, Ree's daughter, driving a little pickup. And she was very upset. She came barreling down the off-ramp and turned left on San Vicente. Did she see you? She nearly ran me down. I'm not sure she realized it, but she nearly knocked me ass over tea kettle coming off the exit. I looked at my watch because I knew my times would be screwed up, and it pissed me off. Did anyone see you? Sure. Some guy working on a busted water main. They had a crew out there. You probably don't remember, but we had some heavy rainstorms over Christmas that year. With the ground saturated, the soil was shifting, and those old pipes were disintegrating every place. You said the alibi wasn't airtight. What's that supposed to mean? He smiled slightly. If you're dead or in federal custody, that's airtight. A hot shoe like Kingman can always find a way to twist facts. All I'm saying is I was miles away and I've got a witness. And he's an honest, hard-working guy, not some piece of shit like, what's his face, McIntyre. What about Tippi? She's never said a word about this as far as I know. Why didn't you confront her? What the hell for? I figured if she'd seen me, she'd have spoken up by now. And even if she spotted me, it's my word against hers. She was 16 years old and hysterical about something. She might have just broken up with her boyfriend or her cat might have died. The bottom line is, I was miles from the house when Isabel was killed. I didn't even know what had happened until an hour later when I jogged past the house again. All the cop cars were there. The place was blazing with lights. What about the repair crew? Will they support your claim? I don't see why not. The guy took the stand before, fellow by the name of Angeloni. He's on the list of witnesses, probably right up at the top. He saw me for sure, and I know he saw her truck. She scared me so bad I had to sit on the curb and get my heart back to normal. It took me 5 or 6 minutes until I was okay again. By then I said to hell with it and headed on home. And you told the cops this? Go read the report. Cops figured me for the murder, so they didn't pursue it. I was silent for a moment, wondering what to make of it. 2 days ago, his claims would have seemed preposterous. No, I wasn't sure. I'll pass this on to Lonnie when I talk to him. That's the best I can do. Jesus, was I going to have to go out and corroborate his alibi? He started to say more and then seemed to think better of it. Fine, you do that. That's really all I'm asking. I appreciate your time, he said. His eyes met mine briefly. I thank you for this. It's all right, I said. He returned to his car. I watched him in the rearview mirror while he started the engine and backed out of the drive. He pulled away, and I listened to the sound of his transmission as he shifted gears. Curious story. Something rang a bell, but I couldn't think what it was. Was Tippi Parsons really at the intersection? It seemed as if there must be a way to find out. I remembered reading about the storm coming through about that time. I started the VW and pulled away from the curb, heading for the appointment with his ex-wife. The Santa Teresa Medical Clinic, where Laura Barney worked, was a small wood-frame structure in the shadow of St. Terry's Hospital, which was 2 doors away. The exterior was plain, ever so faintly shabby. The interior pleasant, but leaning toward the low budget. The chairs in the waiting room had molded blue plastic seats and metal legs linked together in units of 6. The walls were yellow, the floors a marbleized vinyl tile, tan with white streaks. There was a wide wooden counter at one end of the room. On the far side, through the wide archway, I could see 4 desks, straight-backed office chairs, telephones, typewriters. Nothing high-tech, streamlined, or color-coded. The rear wall was lined with tan metal file cabinets. I gathered from the scattering of toddlers, pregnant women, and wailing infants that this was a combination maternity and well-baby facility. It was almost closing time, and the patients still waiting had probably been backed up for an hour. Children's toys and ripped magazines were strewn across the floor. I moved to the counter, spotting Laura Barney by her name tag, which read L. Barney, R.N. She wore a white pantsuit uniform and white crepe-soled shoes. I judged her to be somewhere in her early 40s. She had reached an age where she could still achieve the same fresh good looks she'd enjoyed 10 years earlier. It just took a lot more makeup, and the effect probably wore off after an hour or two. At this time of day, the layers of foundation and loose powder had become nearly translucent, showing skin underneath that was reddened from cigarette smoke. She looked like a woman who'd been forced to go out into the workplace and wasn't at all happy with the necessity. She was currently in the process of instructing a new employee, probably the same young girl I'd spoken to on the phone. Laura was counting out money like a bank teller, flicking bills through her fingers almost faster than the eye could see, turning each bill so it was right side up. If she came across a denomination that was out of place, she would slide it into the proper sequence. Every bill should face in the same direction, and they should be arranged with the smallest bills in front. Ones, fives, tens, twenties, she was saying. That way you'll never inadvertently make change with a $10 bill when you mean to use a one. Look at this. She fanned them out like a magician performing a card trick. I almost expected her to say, pick a bill, any bill. Instead, she said, are you listening? Yes, ma'am. The young woman might have been 19, 15 pounds overweight, with dark curly hair, flushed cheeks, and dark eyes glinting with suppressed tears. L. Barney, R.N., opened the cash drawer again and removed an unruly wad of bills, which she held out silently. The young clerk took them. Self-consciously, she began to sort through the handful of bills, turning one upright in an awkward imitation of Laura Barney's expertise. Several denominations were out of sequence, and she held the wad against her chest while she tried to straighten them out, dropping two fives in an attempt to get them in the correct order. She stammered an apology, stooping quickly to retrieve them. Laura Barney watched her with a slight smile, eyes nearly glittering with the urge to snatch the money back and do it for her. She must have itched to demonstrate the smooth, seamless effort with which an experienced cashier could perform so elementary a task. The absorption with which she watched seemed to make the girl more clumsy. Her own manner was brisk, efficient. She'd picked up a ballpoint pen, which she was clicking impatiently. She wasn't going to waste a lot of time and sympathy. Get 'em in, get 'em out. Payment is expected at the time services are rendered. Her smile was pleasant, but fixed, and probably ran only for the few seconds necessary to register the chill underneath. If you tried to complain later to the clinic doctor, you'd be hard-pressed to put your finger on her failings. I dealt with people like her before. She was all form and no content, a stickler for detail, an avid enforcer of the rules and regulations. She was the kind of nurse who assured you your tetanus shot would feel like a little bee bite, when in truth it'd raise a knot on your arm the size of a doorknob. She looked up at me, and the fixed smile returned. Yes? I'm Kinsey Milhone, I said. I half expected her to hand me a clipboard with a medical history to be completed. Just a moment, please, she said. Her manner suggested that I'd made an unreasonable demand for immediate service. She finished dealing with the clerk and then called two patients in rapid succession. Mrs. Gonzalez? Mrs. Russo? Two women rose from their respective chairs. One carried a swaddled infant, the other had a toddler affixed to one hip. Both had preschool-aged children in addition. Laura Barney held open the wooden gate that separated the waiting area from the corridor leading back to examining rooms. The two women and accompanying children passed in front of her, thus emptying the waiting room. She continued to hold the gate open. You want to come with me? Oh, sure. She picked up two charts, like menus, and herded us into the rear, issuing instructions in rapid Spanish. Once everyone had been ushered into examining rooms, she continued on down the hall, crepe soles squeaking on the tile floor. The room she showed me into was a 9x9 generic office with one window, a scarred wooden desk, two chairs, and an intercom. The kind of setting where you're apt to receive the bad news about the lab tests they just ran. She shut the door and motioned to one chair while she cranked open the window and took a seat herself. She removed a pack of Virginia Slims and a pack of matches from her uniform pocket and lit a cigarette. She glanced surreptitiously at her watch while pretending to adjust the band. You came to ask about David. What exactly did you want to know? I take it you're not on friendly terms with him. I get along with him fine. I hardly see the man. You also testified at his murder trial, didn't you? Generally, I'm used to demonstrate what an unscrupulous bastard he is. You haven't read the transcripts? I'm still in the process of reviewing all the paperwork. I was hired Sunday night. I've got a lot of ground to cover yet. It would be helpful if you could fill in some of the facts from your perspective. The facts. Well, let's see now. I met David at a party. Well, it was 9 years ago this month. How's that for touching? I fell in love with him, and we were married 6 weeks later. We'd been married about 2 years when he was offered a position with Peter Weidman's firm. Of course, we were thrilled. I interrupted. How did that come to pass? Through a friend of a friend. We were living in Los Angeles, very interested in getting out. David heard Peter had an opening, so he applied. We'd been in Santa Teresa all of 2 months when Isabel came on board. David didn't even like her. I thought she was very bright and very talented. I was the one who insisted we befriend her. After all, she was the light of Peter's eye. He was her mentor, in effect. It wasn't in David's best interest to be competitive when she was assigned to work on all the high-visibility projects. I encouraged David to cultivate her both socially and professionally, so I guess you could say I engineered their entire relationship. How did you find out about their affair? Simone let something slip. I forget now what it was, but suddenly everything made sense. I knew David had been distant. It was common knowledge that Isabel and Kenneth were having problems. It took me a while to put two and two together, that's all. None so blind, etc. I confronted him like a fool. I wish now I'd kept my mouth shut.
Why is that?
I forced his hand. Their relationship didn't last. If I'd had the presence of mind to ignore what was happening, the affair might have blown over.
Do you think he killed her?
It had to be someone who knew her pretty well. The intercom buzzed abruptly. She depressed the button.
Yes, doctor?
The doctor sounded like he was calling from a public telephone booth.
We're doing a pelvic on Mrs. Russo. Could you come in?
She said, yes, sir, to him, and then to me, I have to go. Anything else you want is going to have to wait. She held the door open for me, and I passed through. Within seconds, she was gone, and I was left to find my own way out. I went back to my car and sat there for a minute while I dug my wallet from the depths of my leather shoulder bag. I removed all the paper money and carefully rearranged the bills, turning them so they all faced in the same direction. One's in front, a 20 bringing up the rear. I drove back to the office and parked my car in Lonnie's slot, taking the stairs two at a time up to the third floor. If Ida Ruth was surprised to see me back, she kept it to herself. I unlocked my office and started going through the files, which were somewhat better organized, but still loosely arranged on every available surface. I found the file I was looking for and moved over to the desk, where I clicked on the light and settled down in my swivel chair. What I pulled out were the photocopies of the 6-year-old newspapers I'd pulled in preparation for canvassing the Barney's neighbors. Sure enough, for the days in question, there was ample reference to the heavy rainfall over most of California. There was also mention of emergency crews from the Public Works Department working overtime to repair the rash of burst water pipes. The same weather pattern had spawned a minor crime spree. Felons running amok apparently stimulated by the shift in atmospheric conditions. I flipped through the pages, scanning item after item. I wasn't really sure what I was looking for. A link, some sense of connection to the past? The questions were obvious. If Tippi Parsons could support David Barney's alibi, why hadn't she stepped forward with the information years ago? Of course, she might not have been there. He might have seen someone else, or he might have manufactured her presence to suit his own purposes. If she was there, she might not have seen him. There was always that chance. But placing her at the scene would certainly lend credibility to his claims. And what about the guy Barney claimed was at the scene? Where was he in all this? I reached for the telephone and dialed Ree Parsons, hoping to catch her in her studio. The number rang 4 times, 5, 6. On the 7th ring, she answered, sounding breathless and out of sorts.
Yes?
Ree, this is Kinsey Milhone. Sorry to disturb you. It sounds like I caught you right in the middle of your work again.
Oh, hi. Don't worry about it. It's my own fault, I guess. I should get a portable telephone and keep it out in the studio. Sorry for all the heavy breathing. I'm really out of shape. How are you?
I'm fine, thanks. Is Tippi there by any chance?
No, she works until 6 tonight.
Santa Teresa Shellfish, is there something I could help you with?
Maybe so, I said. I was wondering where she was the night Isabel was killed.
She was home, I'm sure. Why?
Well, it's probably nothing, but somebody thought they saw her driving around in a pickup.
A pickup?
Tippi never had a pickup.
It must be a mistake, then.
Was she with you when the police called?
You mean about Isabel's death?
There was a moment of hesitation, which I should have taken as a warning, but I was so intent on the question, I forgot I was dealing with a M-O-T-H-E-R.
She was living with her father during that period, she said with care.
That's right, so you said. I remember that now. Did he have a truck?
Dead silence. Then, you know, I really resent the implications here.
What implications? I'm just asking for information.
Your questions sound very pointed. I hope you don't mean to suggest she had anything whatsoever to do with what happened to Iz.
Ree, don't be silly. I'd never suggest such a thing. I'm trying to disconfirm a report. That's all it is.
What report?
Look, it's probably nothing, and I'd rather not get into it. I can talk to Tippy later. I should have done that in the first place.
Kinsey, if somebody's making some claim about my daughter, I'm entitled to know. Who said she was out? That's an outrageous accusation.
Accusation? Wait a minute. It's hardly an accusation to say she was driving around in a pickup truck.
Who told you such a thing?
Ree, I'm really not at liberty to divulge my sources. I'm working for Lonnie Kingman, and that information is privileged.
This was not true, but it sounded good.
Lawyer-client privilege didn't extend to me and had nothing to do with any witnesses I might approach. I could hear her try to get a grip on her temper.
I'd appreciate it if you'd tell me what's going on. I promise I won't ask about your sources, if that's really an issue.
I debated briefly and decided there was no reason to withhold the information itself. Someone claims to have seen her out that night. I'm not saying it has any bearing on Isabel's death, but it struck me as odd that she's never spoken up. I thought she might have mentioned something to you.
Ree's tone was flat. She's never spoken up because she wasn't out.
Great. That's all I need to know.
Even if she was, it's no business of yours.
I cupped a mental hand behind my mental ear. Even if she was, meaning what? I said.
Nothing. It's a turn of phrase.
Would you ask her to call me?
I'm not going to ask her to call you.
Do what you like, Ree. I'm sorry for the interruption. I banged down the receiver, feeling my face suffuse with heat.
What was her problem?
I made a note about a subpoena for Tippy Parsons, if there wasn't one already. I hadn't attached that much credence to Barney's claim, until I heard Ree's reaction. I buzzed Ruth on the intercom and asked her to order me a complete new set of transcripts from the criminal trial. Then I slouched down in my swivel chair, my feet up on the desk, fingers laced in front of me, as I thought about developments. No doubt about it. Things were looking bad. Between Morley's sloppy records and his untimely death, we had a mess on our hands. Lonnie's prime witness suddenly seemed unreliable, and now it looked as though the defendant actually had an alibi. Lonnie wasn't going to like this. It was better that he hear it now than on the first day of the trial when Herb Foss made his opening remarks to the jury, but it still wasn't going to sit well. He was going to get home Friday night and spend a lovely weekend with his wife. He'd been married for 8 months to a Kenpo karate instructor whom he had successfully defended against charges of felonious assault. I'm still trying to find out what Maria actually did, but all Lonnie would tell me is that the court case stemmed from a rape attempt by a man now retired from active life. I pulled my wandering thoughts back to the situation at hand. When Lonnie ambled into the office Monday morning, the dog-do would start flying. Some of it was bound to land on me. I went back through the list of prospective witnesses Lonnie'd acquired on discovery. A William Angeloni was listed, though his deposition hadn't been taken. I made a note of his address, checked the telephone book, and made a note of his number. I picked up the receiver and then set it down again. Better to do this in person so I could see what he looked like. Maybe he was some kind of sleazeball David Barney'd hired to lie for him. I shoved some papers in my briefcase and headed out again. The address was over on the west side, the house a small stucco bungalow undergoing an extensive remodeling. The roof had been peeled back and the walls on one side had been ripped out. Big sheets of cloudy plastic were nailed across the studs, protecting whatever portions of the house remained untouched. Lumber and cinder block were neatly stacked to one side. There was a big dark blue dumpster sitting in the drive, filled with broken drywall and ancient 2x4s, sporting bent and rusty nails. It looked as if the laborers had all left for the day, but there was a guy standing in the yard with a beer can in one hand. I parked my car across the street and got out, crossing to the borders of his now scruffy lawn.
I'm looking for Bill Angeloni. Is that you by any chance?
That's me, he said.
He was in his mid-30s, extraordinarily good-looking, dark, straight hair worn slightly long and brushed to one side, dark brows, dark eyes, strong nose, dimples, and a manly chin that probably took 6 swipes of a razor to shave properly. He wore jeans, muddy work boots, and a blue denim shirt with the sleeves rolled up. The hair on his forearms was dark and silky. He smelled of damp soil and metal. He looked like an actor who'd star in some movie about a doomed love affair between an heiress and a park ranger. I thought it was probably inappropriate to fling myself against him and bury my nose in his chest. Kinsey Milhone, I said, introducing myself. We shook hands briefly, and then I told him who I worked for. I just had a chat with David Barney, and he mentioned your name. Angeloni shook his head. I can't believe that poor son of a bitch has to go to court again. He finished his beer, crushed the can, and fired a jump shot, tossing the empty container in the dumpster with a plunking sound. He said, 2 points, and made crowd sounds with his fist against his mouth. He had a nice smile, unpretentious. This time it's wrongful death, I said.
Jesus, what about double jeopardy? Isn't that what it's called? I thought you couldn't be tried twice.
That applies to criminal. This is civil.
I'm glad I'm not him. You want a beer? I just got home from work, and I always suck down a few. This place is a mess. You better watch out for loose nails.
Sure, I'll have one, I said, and followed him toward the kitchen, which I could see clearly through the plastic. His butt was cute, too. How long has this been going on?
The remodel? About a month. We're adding a big family room and a couple bedrooms for the kids.
Scratch the wedding, I thought, as we pushed into the kitchen. He took 2 beers from a 6-pack and popped the tops on both.
I gotta fire up the barbecue before Juliana gets home with the little rugrats in tow. My turn to cook, he said, dimpling.
How many kids? He held up one hand and wiggled his fingers.
5. Plus 1 in the hatch. They're all boys. We're looking for a little girl this time.
Are you still with the water department?
10 years in May, he said. You're a private investigator? What's that like?
I talked idly about my work while he dumped the ashes from the Weber grill. He had a flat electrical starter that he plugged into an extension cord, mounting on charcoal briquettes, which he rearranged with a set of long metal pincers. I knew I should press for information. All I needed was confirmation of David Barney's whereabouts the night of the murder, the possible identification of Tippi Parsons, too, but there was something hypnotic about all the homely activity. I'd never been with a man who'd cared enough to fire up a Weber grill on my behalf. Lucky Juliana.
Could you tell me about the night you saw David Barney? There wasn't much to it. We were out digging up the street, trying to find a broken pipe. It had been pouring for days, but it wasn't raining right then. I heard a thump and looked up to see this guy in a running suit sprawled in the street. A pickup was turning left onto San Vicente, and I guess it nearly nailed him. He picked himself off the pavement, limped over to where we were, and sat down on the curb. He was shaken, but not hurt. Mostly mad, you know how it is. We offered to call the paramedics, but he wouldn't hear of it. He sat till he caught his breath, and then he took off again, kind of slow and limping. The whole business lasted maybe 10 minutes or so.
Did you see the driver of the truck?
Not really. It was some young girl, but I didn't get a clear look at her face.
What about the license number? Did you catch that?
He shrugged apologetically. I never even thought to look. The truck was white. I know that.
You remember the make?
Ford or Chevy, I'd guess. American, at any rate.
How'd you find out who David Barney was? Did he introduce himself?
Not at the time. He got in touch with us later.
How'd he know who you were?
He tracked us down through the department, me and my buddy James. He knew the date, time, and location, so it wasn't that tough.
Can James confirm this?
Sure. We both talked to the guy.
At the time Mr. Barney got in touch with you, did you know about his wife's murder?
I'd been reading about it in the paper. I didn't realize the connection until he told us who he was.
Jesus, that was nasty. Did you hear about that?
That's why I'm here. The guy still swears he didn't do it.
Well, I don't see how he could.
He was miles away.
You remember the time?
About 1:45. Might have been a little earlier, but I know it wasn't later because I looked at my watch just as he was taking off.
Didn't it seem odd to see someone out jogging at 1:30 in the morning?
Not a bit. I'd seen him jog along the same path the night before. Emergency work, you see, all kinds of things.
You testified at the murder trial, didn't you?
Sure.
What about this round? Will you testify again?
Absolutely. Glad to do it. The poor guy needs a break.
I thought back through Barney's story, trying to remember what he'd told me.
What about the cops? Did the police ever interview you?
Some homicide detective called, and I told him everything I knew. He thanked me, and that's the last I ever heard from him. I tell you one thing, they didn't like him.
They had him tried and convicted before they even got him into court.
Well, thanks. I appreciate this. You've given me a lot of information. I may get back in touch if I have any other questions.
I gave him my card in case he thought of anything else. I crossed back to the car and sat there, making notes while his comments were still fresh.
I thought about Tippy, searching my memory. Ree had told me those were Tippy's teen alcoholic days. If I remembered right, Ree had sent her off to live with her father because she and Tippy had had a falling out. So how would Ree know if she was in that night or not? Maybe I should just ask Tippy and be done with it.
Do the obvious had always been a working motto of mine. I glanced at my watch. It was 5:35. Santa Teresa Shellfish was out on the wharf, maybe 2 blocks from my apartment, which was not that far away. I headed for home across the backside of Capillo Hill. If Tippy was out that night, I couldn't see why she wouldn't own up to it 6 years later. Maybe nobody'd ever asked her. What a happy thought.
End of Disc 4. Disc 5.
Chapter 12. I parked the car in front of my place, dropped off the briefcase, plucked my windbreaker off the back of the door, and walked the 2 blocks to the wharf. The sun wasn't quite down yet, but the light was gray. The days were marked by this protracted twilight, darker shadows gathering among the trees, while the sky remained the color of polished aluminum. When the sun finally set, the clouds would turn purple and blue, and the last rays of sun would pierce the gloom with shafts of red. Winter nights in California were usually in the 50s. Summer nights were often in the 50s, too, which offered the possibility of sleeping year-round beneath a quilt. To my right, a quarter mile away, the long, slender arm of the breakwater curved around the marina, cradling sailboats in its embrace. The ocean pounded on the sea wall, the force of the waves creating a plume of spray that marched from right to left. Beneath my feet, the pier seemed to shift as if nudged by the waves. The smell of creosote rose like a vapor from heavy timbers saturated to a dark gloss. The tide was high, the water looking like dark blue ink, silver pilings stained with the damp. Cars rolled down the pier, the rumble of loose boards creating a continuous tremor along the length. The fog was rolling in, bringing with it the damp, cloudy smell of seaweed. Darkened boats were moored just offshore in the poor man's marina. On the wharf itself, the lights were bright and cold against the deep shadows of the ocean. The marina restaurant was ablaze, the air around it scented with the savory aroma of char-grilled fish and steaks. One of the parking valets jogged toward the end of the small lot to retrieve a vehicle. Gulls rested on the peaked roof of the bait and tackle shop, the shingled slopes banked with snowy white where the bird droppings had collected. The fishermen were packing up, tackle boxes clattering, while a pelican waddled about, beady-eyed, still hoping for a handout. Looking back toward the town, I could see the dark hills carpeted in pin lights. The 101 was laid out parallel to the beach. the California coastline running an unexpected east to west in this stretch. Across the four lanes of the freeway, the one- and two-story buildings in the business district marched away up State Street, diminishing in size like a drawing lesson in perspective. The palm trees were a dark contrast to the artificial light that was just beginning to bathe the downtown with its pale yellow glow. The sun had now dropped from sight, but the sky wasn't completely dark, more the ashen charcoal gray of a cold hearth. I reached the brown-painted, board-and-batten building that housed the Santa Teresa Shellfish Company. Eight wooden picnic tables and benches were secured to the pier out in front. The three employees inside were young, late teens, in Tippy's case early 20s, wearing blue jeans and dark blue Santa Teresa Shellfish T-shirts, each emblazoned with a crab. Along the front of the booth, seawater tanks were filled with live crabs and lobsters, stacked on one another like sullen marine spiders. A glass-fronted display case was lined with crushed ice, fish steaks, and fillets arranged in columns of gray and pink and white. A counter ran along the back. Beyond it, through a doorway, I could see an enormous fish being gutted. They were in the process of closing up, cleaning off the counters. I watched Tippy for almost a minute before she spotted me. Her motions were brisk, her manner efficient as she waited to take an order from a fellow standing at the display case. "Last order of the day. We gotta close in 5 minutes."
"Oh, right. I'm sorry. I didn't realize it was so late."
He scooted down toward the tank, pointing to the hapless object of his appetite. She tucked her order pad in her pocket and plunged her arm into the murky water. Deftly, she seized the lobster across its back and held it up for his approval. She plunked it on the counter, grabbed up a butcher knife, and inserted the tip just under the shell where the tail connected to the spiny body. I glanced away at that moment, but I could hear the thump as she pounded the knife and neatly severed the creature's spine. What a way to earn a living! All that death for minimum wage. She popped it in the steamer, slammed the door shut, and set the timer. She turned to me without really registering my identity. "Can I help you?"
"Hi, Tippy. Kinsey Milhone. How are you?"
I saw belated recognition flash in her eyes.
"Oh, hi. My mom just called and said you'd be stopping by."
She turned her head.
"Corey, can I go now? I'll close out the register tomorrow if you can do it today."
"No problem."
She turned to the fellow waiting for his lobster dinner.
"You want something to drink?"
"You have iced tea in a can?"
She took the can out of the cooler, put ice in a paper cup, and extracted a small container of coleslaw from the back of the display case. She scribbled the total across the bottom of the ticket and tore it off with a flourish. He gave her a 10, and she made change with the same efficiency. The timer on the steamer began to peep. She reached in with a hot mitt and flopped the steaming lobster on the paper plate. The guy had barely picked up his order when she untied her apron and let herself out the Dutch door to one side.
"We can sit out at one of the tables, unless you'd rather go somewhere else. My car's parked over there. You want to talk in the car?"
"We can head in that direction. I really just have a couple of quick questions."
"You want to know what I was doing the night Aunt Isabel was killed, right?"
"That's right."
I was sorry Reed had time to call her, but what could I do? Even if I'd come straight over, Ree would have had time to telephone. Now Tippy'd had sufficient warning to cook up a good cover story, if she needed one.
"God, I've been trying to think. I was at my dad's, I guess."
I stared at her briefly. "You don't remember anything in particular about that night?"
"Not really. I was still in high school back then, so I probably had a lot of homework or something."
"Weren't you out of school? That would have been the day after Christmas. Most kids have the week off between Christmas and New Year's." She frowned slightly.
"I must have been, if you say so. I really don't remember."
"You have any idea what time your mother called to tell you about Isabel?"
I think about an hour later. Like an hour after it happened. I know she called from Aunt Isabel's, but I think she'd been there a while with Simone.
"Is there any chance you might have been out around 1 or 1:30?
1:30 in the morning? You mean like doing something?"
Yes, a date. Or maybe just bopping around with your buddies.
Nuh-uh. My dad didn't like me to be out late.
He was home that night?
Sure, probably, she said.
Do you remember what your mom said when she called?
She thought about that for a moment. I don't think so. I mean, I remember she woke me up and she was crying and all.
Does your dad have a truck?
Just for work, she said. He's a painting contractor, and he carries his equipment in the pickup.
He had the same truck back then?
He's had the same truck ever since I can remember. He needs a new one, actually.
The one he has is white?
That one slowed her down some. A trick question, perhaps?
Yeah, she said reluctantly.
Why?
Here's the deal, I said. I talked to a guy who says he saw you that night, driving a white pickup.
Well, that's screwed. I wasn't out, she said, with just a touch of indignation.
What about your father? Maybe he was using the truck.
I doubt it.
What's his name? I can check it out with him. He might remember something.
Go ahead. I don't care. It's Chris White. He lives on West Glen, down around the bend from my mom.
Thanks. This has been real helpful. That seemed to worry her.
It has?
I shrugged and said, Well, sure. If your father can verify the fact that you were home, then this other business is probably just a case of mistaken identity.
I allowed just the tiniest note of misgiving to sound in my voice, a little bird of doubt singing in a distant part of the forest. The effect wasn't lost.
Who was it said they saw me?
I wouldn't worry about it. I looked at my watch. I better let you go.
You want a ride or something? It's no trouble.
Little Miss Helpful.
I walked over from my place, but thanks. I'll talk to you later.
Night, she said. Her parting smile seemed manufactured, one of those expressions clouded with conflicting emotions.
If she didn't watch it, those little frown marks were going to require cosmetic surgery by the time she was 30.
I glanced back, and she gave me a half-hearted wave, which I returned in kind.
I headed back down the pier, thinking, Liar, liar, pants on fire, for reasons I couldn't name.
I dined that night on Cheerios and skim milk. I ate, bowl in hand, standing at the kitchen sink, while I stared out the window. I made my mind a blank, erasing the day's events in a cloud of chalk dust. I was still troubled about Tippy, but there was no point in trying to force the issue. I turned the whole business over to my subconscious for review. Whatever was bugging me would surface in time. At 6:40, I left for my appointment with Francesca Voigt. Like most of the principal players in this drama, she and Kenneth Voigt lived in Horton Ravine. I drove west on Cabana and up the long, winding hill past Harley's Beach, entering the ravine through the back gate. The entire Horton property was originally two ranches of more than 3,000 acres each, combined and purchased in the mid-1800s by a sea captain named Robertson, who in turn sold the land to a sheep rancher named Tobias Horton. The land has since been subdivided into some 670 wooded parcels, ranging from 1.5 acre to 50-acre estates, laced with 30 miles of bridle paths. An aerial view might show that two houses, seemingly miles apart, were really only two lots away from each other, separated more by winding roads than by any actual geographical distance. In truth, David Barney wasn't the only one whose property was in range of Isabel's. The Voigts lived on what must have been 6 or 8 acres, if one could judge property lines by the course of the 15-foot hedges that snaked along the road and cut down along the hillside. The shrubs and flower beds were all carefully tended, towering eucalyptus grouped together at the fringes. The driveway was a half circle with a bed of thickly planted pansies massed together in its center, a blend of deep reds and purples, petals vibrant in the glow of the landscape lighting. Off to the right, I could see horse stalls, a tack room, and an empty corral. The air smelled faintly musty, a blend of straw, dampness, and the various byproducts of horse butts. The house was built low to the ground, white frame and white painted brick, with long brick terraces across the front, dark green plantation shutters flanking the wide mullioned windows.
I left my car out in the drive, rang the bell, and waited. A stolid white maid in a black uniform opened the door. She was probably in her 50s and looked foreign for some reason. Facial structure, body type, I wasn't really sure what it was. She didn't quite make eye contact. Her gaze came to rest about at my clavicle and remained there as I indicated who I was and told her that I was expected. She made no reply, but she conveyed with body language that she comprehended my utterings. I followed her across the polished white marble foyer, and then trudged with her across white carpeting as thick and pristine as a heavy layer of snow. We passed through the living room, glass and chrome, not a knick-knack or a book in sight. The room had been designed for a race of visiting giants. All the furniture was upholstered in white and oversized. Big plump sofas, massive armchairs, the glass coffee table as large as a double bed mattress. On a ponderous credenza there was a bowl filled with wooden apples as big as softballs. The effect was strange, recreating the same feelings I had when I was 5. Perhaps, unbeknownst to myself, I'd begun to shrink. We walked down a hallway wide enough for a snowplow. The maid paused at a door, knocked once, and opened it for me, staring politely at my sternum as I passed in front of her. Francesca was seated at a sewing machine in a room proportioned for humans, painted buttery yellow. One entire wall was covered by a beautifully organized, custom-built cabinet that opened to reveal cubbyholes for patterns, bolts of fabric, trim, and sewing supplies. The room was airy, the interior light excellent, the pale hardwood floors sanded and varnished. Francesca was tall, very slender, with short-cropped brown hair and a chiseled face. She had high cheekbones, a strong jawline, a long, straight nose, and a pouting mouth with a pronounced upper lip. She wore loose white pants of some beautifully draped material, with a long peach tunic top that she had belted in heavy leather. Her hands were slender, her fingers long, her nails tapered and polished. She wore a series of heavy silver bracelets that clanked together on her wrist like chains, confirming my suspicion that glamour is a burden only beautiful women are strong enough to bear. She looked like she would smell of lilacs or newly peeled oranges. Francesca smiled as she held her hand out, and we introduced ourselves. "Have a seat. I'm nearly finished. Shall I have Gouda bring us some wine?" "That would be nice." I glanced back in time to see Gouda's gaze drop to Francesca's belt buckle. I took this to mean she had heard and would obey. She nodded and moved out of the room on crepe-soled shoes. "Does she speak English?" I asked once the door was shut. "Not fluently, but well enough. She's Swedish. She's only been with us a month, the poor dear. I know she's homesick, but I can't get her to say much about it." She sat back down at her machine, taking up a length of gauzy blue fabric that she had gathered across one end. "I hope this doesn't seem rude, but I don't like leaving work undone." Expertly she turned the piece, adjusted a knob, and zigzagged a row of stitches across the other end. The sewing machine made a soothing, low-pitched hum. I watched her, feeling mute. I didn't know enough about sewing to form a question, but she seemed to sense my curiosity. She looked up with a smile. "This is a turban, in case you're wondering. I design headwear for cancer patients." "How did you get into that?" She added a small square of Velcro and stitched around the edges, her knee pressing the lever that activated the machine. "I was having chemotherapy for breast cancer 2 years ago. One morning in the shower, all my hair fell out in clumps. I had a lunch date in an hour, and there I was, bald as an egg. I improvised one of these from a scarf I had on hand, but it was not a great success. Synthetics don't adhere well to skulls as smooth as glass. The idea for the business got me through the rest of the chemo and out the other side. Funny how that works. Tragedy can turn your life around if you're open to it." She sent a look in my direction. "Have you ever been seriously ill?" "I've been beaten up. Does that count?" She didn't respond with the usual exclamations of surprise or distaste. Given what she'd been through, merely being punched out must have been an easy fix. "Call me if it ever happens to you again. I have cosmetics designed to cover any kind of bruise you might have. Actually, I have a whole line of products for the ravages of fate. The company's called Head for Cover. I'm the sole proprietress.
How's your health at this point?
I'm fine. Thanks for asking. These days so many of us make it. It's not like the past when any cancer diagnosis meant death. She added the other small square of Velcro, flipped the foot up, removed the garment, and clipped the threads. Deftly, she adjusted the turban around her head. What do you think?
Very exotic, I said. Of course, you could wrap your head in toilet paper and you'd look okay.
She laughed. I like that. Disposable head wraps. She made a note to herself and then set the turban aside, shaking her hair loose. Done. Let's go out on the terrace. We can use the heaters if it seems chilly. The wide stone terrace at the rear of the house looked out over Santa Teresa with a view toward the mountains. In the town below, lights had come on, delineating the layout of city blocks in a grid of streets and intersections.
We settled into wicker chairs padded with plump cushions and floral chintz. The pool was lighted, a glowing blue-green rectangle with a spa at one end. Wisps of steam drifted off the surface, creating a mild breeze scented with chlorine. The surrounding grass looked lush and dark, the house behind us a blaze of yellow. Gouda appeared with a bottle of Chardonnay nestled in a cooler, two long-stemmed wine glasses, and a tray of assorted canapés. I put my feet up on a wicker ottoman and fed myself little treats. Gouda served us water crackers as crisp and flavorless as slate, mounded with soft herb cheese infused with garlic. On the plate with the crackers, she'd arranged tuna-filled cherry tomatoes and flaky homemade cheese sticks. After a sumptuous supper of cold cereal, I had to restrain an urge to snatch at the food like a snarling mongrel. I tried a sip of the wine, a silky blend of apple and oak. Kick-ass private eyes hardly ever live like this. We're the Gallo aficionados of the jug wine set. Count your blessings, I said. Francesca surveyed her surroundings as if seeing all of it through my eyes.
Odd that you should say that. I've been thinking of leaving, Kenneth. I'll wait till the trial is over, but after that I can't think what would keep me.
I was surprised at the admission. Really?
Yes, really. It's a matter of priorities. Winning his love used to seem so important. Now I realize my happiness has nothing to do with him. He did hang in there with me through the surgery and the chemo, and I'm grateful for that. I've heard a lot of horror stories about spouses who can't handle the prolonged stresses of a battle with cancer. I'm the one who's undergone a shift. Gratitude doesn't make a marriage. I woke up one morning and I realized I was out of control.
What triggered the realization?
Nothing in particular. It's like being in a dark room with the lights suddenly flipped on.
What will you do if you leave?
I'm not sure, but something simple. I probably feel the same sense of amazement at this place that you do. I wasn't born with money. My father was a grade school custodian, and my mother worked in a pharmacy stocking shelves with dental floss and Preparation H.
I laughed at the image. Well, you look like you belong here.
I'm not sure that's a compliment. I'm a quick study. When Kenneth and I first started dating, I watched everybody in his crowd. I figured out who was really classy and did whatever they did, with embellishments of my own, of course, just to make it look original. It's just a series of tricks. I could teach you in an afternoon. It's mildly entertaining, but none of it really matters much.
Don't you enjoy having all these things?
I suppose so. I mean, sure, it's nice, but I spend most days in the sewing room. I could do that anywhere.
I can't believe you're saying this. I heard you were nuts about Kenneth.
I thought so myself, and I was, I suppose. I was totally infatuated with him in the early days of our relationship. It was like a form of craziness. I thought he was powerful and strong, knowledgeable, in charge.
Very manly, she said in a deep voice.
He fit my image of what a man should be, but you know what?
He turns out to be rather shallow, which is not to say I'm so profound myself. I woke up one day and thought, what am I doing? Really, it's a struggle to be around him. He doesn't read. He doesn't think about things. He has opinions, but no ideas. And most of his opinions he picks up from Time magazine. He's so shut down emotionally, I feel as if I'm living in a desert.
That sounds like half the people I know, I said.
Maybe so. It might just be me, but he's changed a lot in the last few years. He's so brooding and dark. You've met him, haven't you? What's your reaction?
I shrugged noncommittally. He seems okay, I said. I'd only met the man once, and though I didn't find him attractive, I'm wary about bad-mouthing one spouse to another. For all I knew, they'd reconcile later in the evening, and all my remarks would be reported verbatim. I shifted the subject. Speaking of reactions, what was yours to Isabel? I take it that's part of what your testimony will be about.
Francesca made a face, stalling her response until she'd topped off our wine glasses. That and the infamous gun disappearance. All of us were there. As for Isabel, she was a bit like Kenneth in some ways. Charismatic on the surface, but under that, nothing. She did have talent, but as a person she was hardly warm or caring.
You and Kenneth connected up once she got involved with David Barney?
That's right. We met at a fundraiser at the Canyon Country Club. I was there with a friend and someone introduced us. Isabel had just left him, and he was like a whipped puppy dog. You know how it is. There's nothing quite as irresistible as a man in need of help. I was smitten. I pursued him. I thought I'd die if I couldn't have him. I must have looked like a